Washington versus Commonwealth, Helen E. Phillips, Appellate Counsel, Elizabeth Sherman Fitzgerald, Assistant Attorney General, Commonwealth.
You may proceed.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court, I'm Helen Phillips on behalf of Sean Lynn Botkin. May I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal? This case involves an imposition of a mandatory minimum sentence pursuant to Virginia Code Section 18.2-308.2 for two charges of possession of a firearm after having been convicted of a felony in conjunction with Code Section 19.2-308. The circuit court was correct when it sentenced Mr. Botkin to two concurrent sentences for the two convictions. It was decided based on the Code of Virginia and the decisions of this court in Brown and Baker, as well as the decisions of the Court of Appeals in AC and Bradshaw. And we're asking that the court reverse the Court of Appeals and uphold the decision of the circuit court in this case.
Well, doesn't the statute language that says it's served consecutively with any other sentence, how does that exclude multiple sentences under the same statute? How do you get there?
Because you have to take into consideration the entire sentence, which it talks about mandatory minimum terms of imprisonment prescribed for violations of this section. It uses that phrase to refer to 18.2-308.2 shall be served consecutively with any other sentence. And I submit that is the same analysis that this court used in Brown on 18.2-53.1, that the language shall be served consecutively with any other sentence is equivalent to the language in that code section in Brown, any punishment received for the commission of the primary felony. That there is extensive case law where this court in the General Assembly uses different language, and it did in the same statute. The intent was to give different interpretations to the different language. So that language that I'm referring to is this section versus any other sentence.
Why doesn't it say concurrently with any other conviction under this statute? It just says any other sentence. Why couldn't there be two sentences on two different occasions under this same statute, which would not be allowed to be run concurrently?
Well, the whole argument is that it's either or. They can run them concurrent or they can run them consecutive. I mean, that's essentially the argument in this case, that it doesn't shut that door on running them concurrently. And it is that different phraseology that permits that, and in addition to 19.2-308. So we start with the presumption that a sentence, when it's announced, when there's two sentences, that they run consecutive. And this court, there's a Virginia Appeals Court decision, Nicholson v. Commonwealth, where it says the general rule in Virginia, both before we had 19.2-308 and since, is that sentences run consecutively and not concurrently. While a trial court has the discretion to order concurrent sentences, it must be circumspect in doing so, given the statutory preference for consecutive sentencing. That if both of those are allowed, it's not mutually exclusive. It's not one or the other. It's not like all the sentences have to be concurrent. That's not the argument in this case. It's just that in this limited case, it was correct. The circuit court was correct to do so. And it considered the decisions that are essentially using this analysis of the single possession doctrine, which comes out of the AC decision in the Court of Appeals, under this very same code section. And it talks about when a defendant possessed firearms, a number of firearms, the number isn't relevant, that it's the dangerousness of just a convicted felon having one. So if there's a search warrant and there's three firearms found, that case law holds the presumption that that's 2 years on.
But that's a unit of prosecution analysis. That's not a consecutive versus concurrent punishment analysis.
But it, gets to the decision on how many sentences are rendered, which is the same analysis that is, you know, this makes a big difference to Mr. Botkin because it's 4 years versus 2 years in prison.
Well, it's the difference between having two indictments versus one indictment. A unit of prosecution analysis limits it to the definable statutory unit.
Well, and it goes back to the way this case was, the posture of this case. I was not counsel in the circuit court, and the circuit judge even on page 56 of the joint appendix references the fact that, well, these are guilty pleas. And I think when he was confronted with the actual facts and the other conviction for the same weapon, the muzzleloader in Bristol Circuit Court, using the Brown analysis, was, you know, his decision was correct because he was trying to adjust that, and that adjustment, I submit, is correct using the AC analysis, and furthermore going into the Baker analysis, which this court decided and cited the AC case for that argument that Baker was the same gun. A gun is stolen. Baker ends up showing the gun that same day to a Confederate. He shows that same gun to somebody he tries to sell it to a couple of days later. And then the next day, boom, he's caught with an undercover cop and he sells that gun to the cop. And that's 2 × 2 × 2. That's 6 under that analysis. So trying to run those together and use the AC analysis in both of those, it was the correct decision. There is valid case law for what the circuit court judge did in this situation.
But again, that's a unit of prosecution analysis, is it not? Do you know what I mean by that? Unit of prosecution, there can only be one indictment, no matter how many times he puts his hand on the gun or whatever.
Well, that's...
But if there can be two indictments and there are two units of prosecution, then you have two sentences. It's a different question.
But Justice Kelsey, my argument is that the circuit court judge, you can't ignore the Bristol. The facts in this case are the man buys the gun at Cabela's in Bristol. He tells them he's a convicted felon. They say, well, it's okay, you can buy this muzzleloader. He buys it. He gets popped right there on that date of sale. That's the date of the offense for possession of a firearm after having been a convicted felon. Then when it gets in front of the Scott Circuit Court, it's that same muzzleloader. 7 days later, he's possessing that in Scott County on November 21. So that's units of prosecution, but we do have two different jurisdictions. And it essentially, I mean, nothing's perfect, Your Honor, but that decision was the best use of discretion by a circuit court judge because it shoehorned those cases into the correct analysis given the facts. I mean, the judge references the fact, it's on page 55 of the joint appendix, he says there's one thing in that pre-sentence report that basically bothers him. And I go through that whole pre-sentence report. Well, I know what it is because I know this judge. That Mr. Botkin says to the probation officer when they do the pre-sentence report, he says, they told me I could have it. They told me I could buy it. And what is more frustrating than knowing as a judge that what you're telling people when you, that's what this circuit court judge says when he goes into it. He says, and I've seen him do it numerous times. He's very, very down to earth, a matter of fact, and he explains to everybody when he convicts them of a felony that they can't have a gun. He goes into detail about
what the question, though, is not whether or not he exercises discretion prudently, but whether the statute was through discretion. Isn't that the issue?
And that's why I'm saying it does, because of that's the Brown case, Your Honor. That was the same analysis. It was language tantamount to the same language, and this court decided that it was okay for that, you know, in that circumstance. And the Brown case, again, had different facts that cried out for some sort of modification, and those facts were it was somebody that had never been convicted of a felony before. He had the series of three different weapons. He was, I believe, 19 or 20 when this happened. I mean, in that case, the circuit court judge did multiply them or add them together, and this court reversed that by saying that the way that was worded, you could run them concurrent. It didn't have to be run consecutive. It's that underlying 19.2-308, or even as the Nicholson case said, even in the world before that code section was enacted, there has always been the assumption that if defense counsel doesn't make the motion, the trial court's not going to even consider running sentences concurrently. I mean, that's how valid that presumption is. And this doesn't you know, upset the apple cart or, you know, put an end to what we anticipated the General Assembly meant when it wrote this statute, because it's the same analysis, and if they want to change it, well, first of all, they never changed it. They did change 19.2-53.1. The Brown decision was in 2012, but they didn't go back and look at this section and change it. And there hasn't, you know, if this decision goes in Bodkin's favor, that the circuit court was correct, then obviously that's what the General Assembly will do. And also, the General Assembly did amend this statute, I think about 3 months after this sentencing, to where the muzzleloader isn't included unless it's a violent felony. They specifically carve out the exception for that. And I think that's the other piece of the factual components of this case that are really relevant. This was a weapon that isn't considered that dangerous, because if you go into units of prosecution and you go into multiple possessions, I mean, all of that, I think there was an attorney this morning that used the lines, competing lines of wisdom. I think those two kinds of cases are competing lines of wisdom. I don't think the irony is missed that on September 11 we're having this discussion about, all right, you take the position that we've got a status offender, a convicted felon, he should not have a gun or she should not have a gun. If he's found with four guns, he's just as dangerous as he has one. But if he has one in this building today and in the General Assembly building tomorrow, it's, you know, it's twice as dangerous because of those two different occurrences. I mean, there's a conundrum in all of that that perhaps, you know, we can't solve all these problems. But getting back to the instant case, this man, he was told by a business that he could have it. I mean, he says his wife bought it for him. She testified she bought it for him. So, and then things go bad in the relationship within a week, and it goes the other way. But
why couldn't the discretion that you feel in a factual scenario like this would be perfectly reasonable be exercised under the statutory scheme by the judge saying, okay, 3 years, and I suspend 3 years on the second charge, and I run them consecutively? But doesn't that accommodate the equity situation that the sentencer should be considering?
But I think the way the mandatory...
The mandatory minimum kicks in and eliminates all discretion.
Right. I mean, if he has to impose two mandatory minimum sentences, he ran them concurrent instead of consecutive.
You wanted to save 3 minutes. You could use your time any way you'd like, however.
Yes, if I may reserve that.
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning again, and may it please the Court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. Code Section 18.2-308.2 required the trial judge in this case to run the defendant's sentences consecutively. As held by the Court of Appeals, the trial judge's decision that he had the discretion to impose concurrent sentences was error. Accordingly, this case should be reversed and remanded back to the trial court for resentencing in accordance with the Court of Appeals opinion. The penalty provision of Code Section 18.2-308.2 is unambiguous. It provides, quote, "the mandatory minimum terms of imprisonment prescribed for violations of this section shall be served consecutively with any other sentence." As this Court has previously held, the word "any" is an unrestricted modifier. It applies without limitation, and it has expansive meaning. If you look it up in the dictionary, any is defined as every and all. Giving that phrase "any other sentence" its plain meaning here, the trial judge was required to run the defendant's mandatory minimum sentence consecutively with any other sentence, with all other sentence, with every other sentence. And certainly that includes the second sentence.
Was to eliminate 100% of the possibility of discretion. You
yes,
can't
sir.
Suspend it. You can't. You really can't do anything except impose it.
Yes, given that particular requirement of this code section. Yes.
Let me ask you this. I mean, assuming we end up agreeing with the Commonwealth's position, we have a published Court of Appeals case. Is there any Are there any issues with the way that was written that would preclude us from adopting that opinion as we've done from time to time?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. I don't know what we'll do, but...
Yeah,
let me follow up on that question. You seem to agree when talking about the second assignment of error that the case should be remanded for resentencing. But the language of the Court of Appeals seems to suggest that the Court of Appeals wanted to limit the judge a little bit. Do you read the language that way? What it says is, we reverse the judgment of the circuit court insofar as it imposes concurrent sentences, vacate the portion of the order that so provides, and remand for sentencing in conformity with this opinion. Do you think the trial judge then can sentence however he or she wants to sentence, or are they limited to the sentence that was previously imposed and have to run them concurrent?
I mean, consecutively.
My position is that the trial judge on remand has discretion to impose a sentence anywhere between the two-year mandatory minimum and the max for a Class 6 felony, which these are, which is 5 years. The Court of Appeals in this case cites Graves, C. Graves, right after that statement.
Right.
And in Graves, this court talked about the imposition of a mandatory minimum that was also a mandatory maximum. And there, the trial court would have no discretion on remand because there was, in fact, only one sentence that could be imposed. So in this case, because there are multiple different ways the trial court could go with this, there does need to be a new sentencing hearing. It should be remanded for full consideration of the penalties that are allowed for a Class 6 felony.
So maybe we shouldn't adopt the Court of Appeals opinion to clarify that point.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I mean, I can see how it could be read different ways, but given the language of that and the citation to Grimes and this court's established case law, Grimes cites Rawls, it cites Burrell, and I think that the any confusion that's there is because the Court of Appeals was trying to be careful not to make the same mistake. I think this court noted in Graves that the language in Burrell was imprecise because we only had one sentence there, so we're talking about a sentence that is void as opposed to an order that is void. So I think that Court of Appeals language was going toward trying to be precise as possible there when we're talking about sentences that are imposed outside of statutory range being void as opposed to the whole court's order being void. But to the extent the court feels that clarification is necessary, certainly, I think the correct remand would be for a resentencing hearing to give the trial judge the discretion to operate within the limited bounds that he has.
Do you think that the sentence in this instance was void?
Yes, Your Honor, because it was imposed outside the statutory range. And I think that that's in accordance with this court's determination in Rawls. I don't think I have an ability to argue otherwise. Which was cited in Grimes in the citation that the Court of Appeals put, or not Grimes, I'm sorry, in Graves, which the Court of Appeals addressed in that final sentence there.
You mentioned the range of discretion the trial court would have. Can you flesh that out? What do you think the range actually is on remand?
Well, 18.2, 308.2 lists these crimes, possession of a firearm by a nonviolent felon as a Class 6 felony. That range is normally 1 to 5. Here we have a mandatory minimum that imposes the bottom portion of that range. And so the trial judge is working with 2 years of mandatory time and up to 5 years of total time. And there's three years that aren't mandatory. Of course, the court could impose, could not impose, could impose and suspend.
Depending on what the original thought was that he or she had, and as to what the ultimate outcome should look like.
Yes, dependent on the facts of this case as they were presented to the trial judge. And I think it's important to note, although I don't believe the facts underlying this case are relevant to the issue of whether the trial court had discretion at all in imposing these mandatory minimum sentences to run consecutively. We do have a guilty plea in this case, and the defendant pled guilty to two separate counts of possession. Those were two separate occasions, and as we know from the sentencing hearing, one of those involved hunting and one of those involved brandishing, where one of these guns was pointed at the defendant's ex-wife and her father-in-law. So we do have two separate occasions here under AC and under this court's case law, which even if the defendant hadn't pled guilty to those separate occasions, this is not a case where we're concerned with the prosecution issue, particularly in light of the guilty plea.
So going back to some of the earlier questions, the statutory scheme actually does afford a measure of discretion, not so much on the mandatory minimum bottom floor, but the range, depending on how you want to add these things up consecutively.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's an issue this court grappled with in Graves, where there was no classification for the felony. Here, the code section is very clear that we are dealing with a Class 6 felony, which would give the court some play in determining what the appropriate sentence is.
Right, but the discretion given to the court is only an upward discretion. It's not a downward discretion, and I think that's what defense counsel was talking about. And in this instance, it sounds like the judge really wanted to go downward, and he just does not have the discretion to do so pursuant to statute.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. I don't think that there is no the trial court doesn't have the authority under this code section to impose anything less than 4 years of mandatory time, 2 years for each conviction. However, because we are dealing with a Class 6 felony, the court could, in its discretion, go upwards. And because we are dealing with a sentence that is void, and because there is a range of time there, that decision is for the trial court to make is what would be the appropriate right. sentence under the circumstances. If there are no further questions, I would just repeat that the phrase "any other sentence" encompasses a sentence imposed pursuant to the same code section, and that the appropriate remedy in this case is remand. Thank you, Your Honors.
Rebuttal.
I would just like to respond to two things the Commonwealth argued, and the first is that this was two separate occasions. And in looking at the record, I respect the Commonwealth's citations to what they say that is supported by in the record. But the first thing is the clerk's record, which shows there were two indictments, and they are in the record. And the one for the muzzleloader was on November 21, 2005, and it's really specific. And the warrant accompanies that, and it describes that whole event with the muzzleloader in Scott County. There's not really anything in the record to support, even in the pre-sentence report, what went on with the shotgun. That indictment, that's the other indictment, it's dated November 10, on or about November 10 until on or about November 28. And I submit that November 21 is in that. There is nothing in the record whatsoever in the testimony about the date of the shotgun incident. And I submit that we're entitled to the presumption that we were the prevailing party in the trial court. And when the reviewing court examines that evidence, it must be considered in the light most favorable. And that leads to the conclusion that it's on the same date. It's not two separate occasions.
Were they two separate counties, counsel?
No, the other county was Bristol, the city of Bristol. That was the prior conviction, but this is a conviction out of Scott County. And it
both of the indictments were for Scott County?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And one has a range date and one has a specific date. And that's in the same one. And then the other point I'd like to say is the Commonwealth, in brief and in argument, has talked about any and the use of the word any. But I would refer the court to the Court of Appeals in AC in this same code section. And it's the part of the code, any is in that code section a lot, and it's the phrase any firearm. And this is what the Court of Appeals said. We hold that the word any preceding the object of the offense creates an ambiguity. All are in agreement that it is impossible to decipher what any means. And again, my whole argument is it's that whole phrase. It's not just any or any other. It's the whole phrase to be considered. And based on that and the case law, and the Commonwealth doesn't have any case law to support what it says, that the circuit court opinion should be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.